You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I have a couple of quick announcements as we kick off the new year here. I hope you'll help us fund our production costs for 2017 so I can keep providing you brand new podcasts twice a week. Show your support for the show by giving to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. Whatever you can give is always appreciated and will help us keep going over here in 2017. I also want to ask you to take a brief listener survey so we can better understand you, our audience, and find advertisers who are best matched to your interests. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the podcast. They were the original It couple, freewheeling, hard-drinking, all-night partying, and bordering on reckless. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald were the singular ambassadors of a generation gone wild. Flaunting convention and breaking the old rules along the way, they raced toward everything new, young, and modern, fueled by boundless American optimism and champagne or gin, or whatever they could get their hands on in the not-so-prohibitive days of Prohibition. Newspaper gossip columnists devoted extra space to accounts of Scott and Zelda's boozy late-night antics, like dancing in the fountain outside the Plaza Hotel, or riding on a rooftop on a taxicab up Broadway. For all the world, they seemed to be having the time of their lives. And even today, Scott and Zelda are still looked on as one of the great romances of the 20th century. But theirs was also a relationship undermined by codependency, petty jealousies, and insecurity that descended into madness and alcoholism and tragically ended both of their lives before either could see the age of 50. When he was productive, F. Scott Fitzgerald was brilliant. Many would say the greatest American novelist, but the periods in between were characterized by lengthy procrastination, easy distraction, self-doubt, depression, anger, and near-constant financial worries. Often when afflicted with writer's block, he turned toward his wife for inspiration, encouragement, and it turns out, a lot more. Though often dismissed as a flapper and a dilettante, Zelda was more than a mere muse. As a matter of fact, on more than a few occasions, the very words from her letters and diaries made it into the pages of Scott's novels and short stories, leading modern scholars to take another look at Zelda's own writing. Now Zelda is finally getting her due with a new television series from Amazon called Z, The Beginning of Everything. It stars Christina Ricci as Zelda Sayre Fitzgerald and Australian actor David Hofflin as her husband, Scott. Today, I'll talk with David Hofflin about his role playing the iconic American author. We'll also discuss the lie of the Roaring Twenties as one big party, the often dysfunctional relationship between Scott and Zelda, and whether they might represent a cautionary tale about getting too much too soon. Then I'll talk with the executive producers and creators of Z, The Beginning of Everything, Nicole Yorkin and Dawn Prestwich. Together, they've written and produced many hours of television, including Melrose Place, Chicago Hope, Judging Amy, The Education of Max Bickford, and most recently, the acclaimed AMC series, The Killing. They'll talk about what attracted them to the story of Zelda Fitzgerald and the period of the 1920s. They'll weigh in on whether F. Scott Fitzgerald's borrowing of his wife's words amounts to plagiarism, and whether her husband may have contributed to Zelda's steady descent into madness. Coming up with David Hofflin, Nicole Yorkin, and Dawn Prestwich in just a moment. David Hofflin is the Swedish-born Australian actor who's well-known down under for his roles in the Australian television series Ocean Girl and Neighbours. Here in the U.S., he's starred in the J.J. Abrams drama Alcatraz, as well as notable guest roles on NCIS and NCIS New Orleans, Criminal Minds, Hawaii Five-O, Supernatural, American Crime, and Once Upon a Time. Now he stars as F. Scott Fitzgerald in Amazon's new series Z, The Beginning of Everything. So, David, Scott Fitzgerald, big shoes to fill, huh?
Look, I got to say I'm nervous about this one because I've heard you're quite a Fitzgerald fan. So I think you know more about him than I do. So this is going to be interesting.
I don't know. I figured that you've done your research.
No, I mean, I did do research, but it might not be it wasn't so much research about reading a lot of what people said he was like. Mm-hmm. I did more of the research on reading his own books, reading his novels, and trying to get a grasp of what he thought he was personally. So we'll see how this goes.
That's interesting that you say that, because I feel that even especially as I watch the show, his writing reveals more about him than he would ordinarily reveal about himself in public, because there were two sides to him. There's as he wanted to be seen and perhaps as he saw himself. And then there was this deeply insecure guy who had all these inadequacies and jealousies and so forth. And those only come out in the novels. He's very honest through his characters, don't you think?
I think so. Again, I only started reading This Side of Paradise, mm-hmm. Because I also didn't want to go too far into his life, because this only spans the first season, the first approximately two years mm-hmm. of their life together, and it spans the sort of the emergence and the success of This Side of Paradise. So I spent a lot of time reading that because I did hear that. Amory, however you want to pronounce it. We started with Amory, and then it changed to Amory halfway through. the main sort of character in This Side of Paradise was very much based on F. Scott himself. Mm-hmm. So I did more of a sort of reconnaissance on how he thought of himself and the views that he had, because everyone has an opinion of what F. Scott's like.
Right.
Or seemingly could have been like. And I think it is true. He was a multifaceted individual. He had, I guess most people do, but he did have a seemingly, I think a lot of people that knew him would have maybe explained him in different ways, because mm-hmm. I think he wore a lot of different hats.
Yeah. And it must be tricky for you as an actor playing a real-life character in a series that's based on a novel, where the gaps in the historical account are kind of filled in by the writer's imagination. So in that situation, are you the kind of actor who wants to do a lot of independent research for a role like this? Or are you more inclined to let the writer's version of Fitzgerald speak for itself.
Well, I think specifically for us as well, you know, this is predominantly, it's a story about Zelda, and it's through Zelda's eyes. And I think that's where you have to make the distinction. It's not necessarily about F. Scott and what people thought of F. Scott. It's what Zelda, it's how Zelda perceived it, or at least how Teresa Ann Fowler perceived Zelda to perceive it. So, you know, in that kind of way, we did have conversations on set of how to broach certain subjects to make it, I guess applicable would be the word in that scenario. There's so many different ways that you can take his life, his history, his writing, and his relationship that we are focusing on a certain point of view that other people may actually disagree with. But at the end of it all, it is Zelda's story, and he's certainly a big part of that story.
We tend to romanticize the relationship between Scott and Zelda as one of the great love affairs of all time. But, in reality, they were pretty screwed up.
All accounts, I think so. I mean, I feel also in the 1920s, we tend to romanticize everything about the 1920s. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that jazz age, the golden era, and there was a lot of money flying around, but there was also that dark side to it. There's prohibition, and there was they'd just come out of the war, and the depression was hitting its straps, I guess. But they also had the race class, all this sort of business that you know you don't necessarily hear a lot about that stuff when you talk about F. Scott. Mm-hmm. He because he's such a prolific writer, I think they do tend to, as one does, martyr a person and only focus on the golden parts of their history. But I think, you know, this delves into a relationship that certainly had a lot of flaws. And when you look just on your quick reading, you can see that there was infidelity. But noticeably, they didn't ever divorce. And I think that's an also telling sign to how passionately they felt towards each other, but also the demons that they had. And I think they each had singular demons that when they brought together became a monster demon.
Do you think Scott Fitzgerald was in love with Zelda or was he obsessed with her?
I think both. Mm-hmm. You know, I do believe that when people say that Zelda was his muse, I do believe that's true. I think we certainly indicate that he can't live without her. He can't perform as well as he can without her. Not only her writing, you know, taking liberties with her writing, but I think from more of a point of view of him seeing her as he did, I think that spurred his passion on a lot as well.
Yeah, and that was interesting in the show. You have instances where he's borrowing little phrases from her writings or things she'll say and inserting that into his own writing. I didn't know about that. Is there some basis for that? I'm curious. Or is that part of the fictionalization of the story?
I think there's both. Look, I've sort of... I have heard different accounts. There are certain people in the camp that say that Zelda didn't have much to do with F. Scott's writing at all. There's others that say she plagiarized a lot. Certainly we're going in the direction of he used her writing from her letters, from her from the diary. But also, you know, they did a bit of writing together as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
I'm not entirely sure how deep, again, I didn't go deeply into that part of it, but there seemed to be a little bit of a collaboration between the two. How much he used, I don't know if anyone really knows.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think that he would have amounted to much without her at his side?
Look, maybe this is just an egotistical point of view because I play him.
Yeah.
he has a wonderful way of expressing himself in his writing, at least from what I've read. I dare say that not 100% of it has come from Zelda. You know, I do think that he had a very strong gift for writing, especially describing things, is at least what I found. There are certain things that I've read. I've read a few short stories of his as well, and things just jump out at the page at you. And
I'm thinking more in the sense of the motivation, because you see that in the show. How,
yeah.
I mean, she is his motivation to
Definitely.
Write and to succeed in life.
Definitely. And I think that that's the part of it, is maybe he doesn't realize how important she is until there's a point where he may lose her or go off on his own. And then, you know, that also ties in with the ego part of F. Scott and the jealousy part of F. Scott. You know, I think he's aware how much of an impact Zelda has on his life.
Yeah. I think most people think Scott was more prolific than he really was. I mean, he certainly wrote a lot of short stories, but in reality, I think he only wrote 5 novels. The last one was unfinished. And one thing that Z, The Beginning of Everything, shows is how Fitzgerald struggled with his writing.
Yeah.
And struggled to get started and delayed and was easily distracted and just kind of tormented by it. I mean, is it fair to say that the process of writing didn't come easily to him?
I think so. You know, I think if you speak to most writers, they have instances of writer's block and trying to find inspiration. But history tells an interesting story, I think, with F. Scott, because he didn't get any recognition for his most famous book until he died. You know, Gatsby did not really do that well until his death.
Yeah.
So that's a very, for me, it's a very sad thing that his most famous novel, he never realized that success. So he passed away at a very young age as well. So I think that sort of brings into it, yes, he only wrote 5 novels, but he also died at the age of 44. So
And this first season covers pretty much the one point in his career where he was very successful, where he skyrocketed to celebrity and fortune on the wings of This Side of Paradise.
Yeah.
And then, you know, anyone who knows him knows that after that, none of his novels, including Gatsby, were anywhere near that successful.
Yeah.
As someone who now has this big new series on Amazon, is there a cautionary tale about the perils of achieving fame and fortune too early and too quickly?
I mean, I plan on emulating F. Scott in every single way. I'm gonna use this. Yep, that's exactly right. I've got nothing left to show for it. This is the thing about F. Scott and Zelda's life, is it only gets more and more colorful as time goes on. And I think the first season of Z is very much just a setup of their lives together. And yes, he found great success very quickly. And I think, you know, they both struggled with that, because then it's when you're at the top of the mountain, there's only one way to go.
Yeah.
And so it's that struggle to keep there. And yes, it was they lived the high life at this point in time, but then they also had the very interesting points of time in Paris and in Hollywood and the Lost Generation and all these sort of things that there's so much to explore from their lives and relationship-wise, and also from Zelda's on a personal level, because obviously she goes through quite a tumultuous time herself, and the opportunity to explore that on a deeper level, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And one thing that I think is so unique about them is that when I look back throughout the history of the 20th century and on different eras like the 30s, the 60s, the 80s, it's hard to think of any cultural icons who were such singular embodiments of their era as Scott and Zelda were to the 20s and the Lost Generation. I mean, it's not like there was any lack of fascinating personalities in the 1920s, Chaplin, Louis Armstrong, Gershwin, Hemingway, Capone. Why do you think Scott and Zelda became such ambassadors of that moment in time?
You know, they were the first celebrity couple as such. And I think maybe that makes a difference, because you have these, as you mentioned, you know, Capone and Chaplin and Hemingway and all these very, very influential people in the 1920s. But I guess if you mention who were their partners, you might know. I don't.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think maybe that's what piqued people's interest then. And certainly now, I think it's been romanticized a lot, as you said.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of makes it interesting because you have a female energy to that male mm-hmm. energy that people perhaps can look at as a separate identity as well as their individual success.
I wonder, you know, do you think that in some ways we're drawn to Scott and Zelda because they represent a version of the 1920s that we want to believe, where it's sort of a sexy lie rather than necessarily the reality of what was going on underneath in this country in the 1920s?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what kind of celebrity is about anyway. Mm-hmm. Even these days now, you know, like if they had Instagram back in the 1920s, I think there'd be problems. If you look at someone's Instagram account, you only see the best parts of their life.
Right.
Or Facebook or Twitter, and you think, wow, what an amazing life they must have. But I'm sure every single person there has their problems. They just don't post those sort of things.
Yeah.
And I guess it was the same back in those days where they just got a taste, the public got a taste of what the Fitzgeralds were, but only when they were out at galas, at dances, at parties.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have thought, wow, they just live the high life.
Yeah.
And you don't really see the debaucherous side of things.
Yeah.
The private things that they went through.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're ready for celebrity because I see big things for you.
Look,
this is a spectacular turn for you.
Yeah.
I wish you all the best going forward here.
I appreciate that. I'm guy incognito most of the time. Yeah. So let's hope that continues.
All right. Well, David Hoffland, thanks so much for talking to me and congratulations.
Thanks very much for having me. Cheers.
We're going to take a quick break, and then when I come back, I'll talk with the executive producers and creators of Z, The Beginning of Everything, Nicole Yorkin and Dawn Prestwich, when we come back in just a moment. So it's a new year now, and there's no better time to launch an online business or expand your online presence for your existing business, and GoDaddy.com wants to help. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures, helping their customers kick ass by giving them the tools, insights, and the people to transform their ideas and personal initiatives into success. GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar with over 62 million domain names under management and big savings over other registrars. Their award-winning 24/7 support will help build your online business and give you everything you need to get up and running. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name, and GoDaddy is trusted by 13 million customers. That's more than any other registrar. And right now, my listeners can get a special discount on a GoDaddy domain if you just use my offer code KICK30 at checkout to get 30% off new purchases. That's GoDaddy.com and offer code KICK30 for 30% off. You don't have to spend a fortune on a domain. Just go to GoDaddy.com and type in the offer code KICK30 at checkout for 30% off and launch your online business today. And now, back to the podcast. I'm talking with Nicole Yorkin and Dawn Prestwich, the executive producers and co-creators of Amazon Z, The Beginning of Everything. Nicole and Dawn, thanks for sitting down with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Z, The Beginning of Everything, tells the story of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald's tumultuous relationship through the eyes of Zelda. Until very recently, I feel like she was largely dismissed as sort of a dilettante or the first flapper. What was it about Zelda that both of you found intriguing?
Yes, we felt that, as you said, most people regarded Zelda as the crazy woman who sort of destroyed her husband's career.
Yeah.
You know, she was attractive and vivacious, but also mentally ill. So we were happy to be part of a movement to sort of rehabilitate Zelda and see her for who she really was, which was a very creative, passionate artist in her own right.
As writers, too, she is a wonderful character. As an actual human being who lived, you couldn't pick a better character in terms of, you know, the flaws and the talent and the, you know, the drama of her life. So I think, you know, we were delighted to be able to tackle that.
I do have to say that you're both very brave women for taking on perhaps America's greatest writer and calling him out or calling him to account, let's say, for generously borrowing from Zelda's own words. Have you received any backlash from the literary community or accusations that this is some kind of feminist revisionism?
Well, we have heard from a few Scott fans who don't think we do him justice. However, we will say that we spoke to a lot of, Scott Fitzgerald experts, professors, other people who felt that this is a fairly fair portrayal of Scott, you know, because we're not saying that he stole everything from Zelda.
No.
At all. We're just saying that, yes, he did borrow, and I think he did have some issues with her being an artist in her own right. But that happened later.
Yeah, I think that as writers, too, we of all people really understood a writer's process.
Yeah.
And Scott was, you know, he fell in love with Zelda, but he was also inspired by her. I mean, she was really the true modern. She was this woman who didn't care what anyone thought. In an era from the South, you know, when all women cared what everyone thought, there were just strict boundaries about the way you were to live your life and the way you were supposed to act. And he was so taken by her that it makes sense that he would then pull her words into his characters as he created characters that were similar to her. Now, there were times, I think, as the years went on, that Zelda started to want to have a creative voice. Mm-hmm. And that's where the problem began for her. Because Scott had sort of marked out his territory, and his territory was their whole life, basically.
Right, yeah.
And
they both couldn't write about the same story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But in the beginning, at least in this first season, she's actually delighted that somebody takes her words seriously enough to actually reprint them.
Yeah, it's a huge turn on for her.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, nobody was taking her seriously in Montgomery. Mm-hmm. She was the belle of the ball. She was beautiful. The guys all wanted to kiss her, you know, et cetera. But you know, nobody really thought of Zelda as a brilliant creative force at that point. So.
Yeah, and I've never actually read The Diary of Zelda Fitzgerald and held it alongside Fitzgerald's work. How much did he actually borrow from her writing? Because there are specific phrases that work their way into his novels, huh?
No, her diary is lost to history. Her diaries are lost to history. We know that Scott read them, and he actually did pass them on to his editor at one point, Maxwell Perkins, and said, you should publish this as a novel. So those have been lost, but what he did borrow from that we know about are some of her letters. And when you there's a passage that we use in episode 104, I guess, which is when they're in the Biltmore Hotel. Mm-hmm. And we see in the episode preceding that, too, that she wrote him a letter and a phrase really catches his eye. And then that reappears in his first novel, This Side of Paradise.
You know, I asked David this same question. Do you think that F. Scott Fitzgerald would have amounted to much without Zelda?
I think he would have amounted to something. Mm-hmm. But
he was a wonderful writer.
He was amazing. Yeah. I mean, he really was a wonderful writer. But the inspiration of Zelda, she really was his muse. Mm-hmm. And she was and the life that they lived. And really, the tragedy of her mental illness, all of that inspired him, and he wrote great, great novels based on that. So, you know.
Well, Hemingway blamed Zelda for Fitzgerald's poor work ethic and lack of output, thought that he probably could have done a lot more if she hadn't been around. Would it be fair to say that she was equal parts distraction as well as muse?
Well, I will start by saying that Hemingway was a famous misogynist.
Right.
And yeah. Hemingway and Zelda truly despised each other.
I think he's a borderline personality, honestly. You know, that's my personal diagnosis.
For people who deal with the Fitzgeralds, oftentimes you either fall on Team Hemingway or Team Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hemingway later turned on Fitzgerald, too.
Right. And he was famously jealous of him.
Yes. And, yeah. And so on. But, you know... she was a distraction in that they liked to go to parties together and revel together, but she stopped drinking a long time before he did.
Oh, yeah. Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, he was an alcoholic through the end of his life. He died of a heart attack, but, you know, she had other issues that she dealt with, but he was somebody who had a serious drinking problem.
Yeah, and one thing that was interesting for me is I usually think of Zelda as the immature, emotionally unstable one in the relationship, and that's how she's been portrayed. But at least in this first season of Z, it seems like she's far more grounded than he is.
Yeah, I think so. I think she was. I think that she had tremendous wisdom when she knew that when he wants to marry her. And he has nothing. You know, his book has just been rejected by the publisher. He has nothing. He wants to marry her so he can have an identity, that, so that he can feel good about himself because he has Zelda. And she knew that's not going to work. I can't be part of that. And so I think that she had a very logical sense of what works in human relationships. However, I don't think she was ready for what New York brought her.
Mm-hmm.
And
in real life, they were both about 20 or 20 and
yeah, they're 21. Babies.
They were young that, you know, they were babies, like Don said. So I don't think either of them had too much wisdom.
Yeah.
Now imagine getting everything you ever wanted by the time you were like 20 or 22, 23. I mean, that's a terrible way to begin life, actually. You know, you can only go down from there, or you can only be desperate to hold on to it, you know, desperate to maintain it.
Yeah, and it's sort of depressing because this season, you know, if you know the history, you know that this is as good as it's
going
to get.
This is the good season.
It's all downhill from here, yeah.
That's what we always said, this is the fun season when everybody's pretty happy.
Yeah, yeah. This is where you get in all the jazz and the fun stuff.
Yeah, there's lots of interesting stuff that happened after this. You know, they had their child. They went to Paris. Mm-hmm. They dealt with, you know,
infidelities and
Gertrude Stein, all those famous people, all the moderns.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wasn't all fun and games.
Now, is that what might come into a season two? I'm hoping that Amazon will do an order for a second season here. I'm thinking Paris, Hemingway. I'm just trying to remember the timeline here.
For many reasons, we would love to go to Paris for next season. Yeah. You know, there are other places we could go because that would be skipping a few years.
Yeah.
So we could go to them having their child, and they were in St. Paul, Minnesota, and New York, you know, for a couple of years, and then they finally went to Paris.
So. We feel like, you know, there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun in Paris, and we feel like we need to live in the fun place as long as we can.
Yeah. You
Since we're going to go to a dark place. Yeah. I mean, this show makes no bones, I think, about, heading in a dark direction. Mm-hmm. These are real people who had a hard life.
And you did actually shoot this in New York City. Is it hard doing a period piece in New York?
It was very difficult because New York isn't what it used to be, obviously. But we had an amazing production designer named Henry Dunn, who was a genius. And, you know, if you see the show, you'll see the Biltmore Hotel, which was actually built on a soundstage at Silver Cup Studios.
Okay. Yeah, there's a speakeasy that Henry just whipped up.
Yeah, and later there's a house in Westport, Connecticut that they lived in that was also, the exterior is a real house, but the interior is all a set.
Yeah.
But we did have to do a little bit of, you know, special effects, CGI work, getting rid of air conditioned grates and, you know, little lights and things that, you know,
wouldn't
have been retells.
And the funny thing is, when I think back 10 or 15 years when I would pitch TV shows, I remember a time when no network would even take a meeting about a period series.
Oh, yeah.
And things have changed so much now. I don't think it's an accident that Amazon is attracting the major stars and the big movie directors and writers that they are. You both have worked together in network television. What do you find different about working with Amazon?
Well, we have to say much of the credit for the series goes to Joe Lewis, who at the time was in charge of half hours at Amazon. Now I think he's in charge of both half hour and hour. But he right away said, yes, I want to do this as a series. And he wanted to do it as a half hour drama, which is something unusual. And, you know, Amazon was willing to back us all the way. It was a great experience.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly unconventional, the whole process. And that was really exciting. I mean, we couldn't believe, because even when Christina and Pam reached out, Pam Coffler reached out to us looking for writers and showrunners, I think we were amazed that Amazon was willing to do this material, to set an entire, to make a show about real people who'd really lived, and that's set in the 20s. It'll go into the 40s, right?
Yeah,
a little bit into the 40s, I think. Okay. Yeah.
Wow. Yes. Yeah, when did she die? She died really tragically in a fire, right?
Yeah.
48.
She did, and you know that's how we start our pilot, and
right.
Not in the first episode, not everybody realizes that's what it was, but she was sedated. She was about to get electroshock treatment the next morning. She was in a mental facility in North Carolina, and a fire broke out, and apparently she never even got out of her bed.
Yeah.
Wow.
They only identified her by a slipper that was
under her body.
Bed.
Yeah.
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 Do you think that F. Scott Fitzgerald contributed perhaps even heavily to her mental unraveling?
Yeah, not necessarily. At the time, she was diagnosed as schizophrenic, and it seems more likely now that she was probably bipolar. And we're not so sure it's Scott as much as the treatment that she received in these
hospitals.
That's
really, that would,
yeah,
when
that
you really think about it, I mean, Scott,
of
course,
health.
Being married to Scott and the life that they led and the insanity of it all, of course, that would contribute. But really, it was the treatment. It was pretty crude.
Like, for instance, they did insulin shock treatment to her, which is something we haven't heard that much about, but they would give her a shot of insulin, which would throw her into she'd have a convulsion, and then she'd have a coma.
Oh,
she'd
God.
Go into coma.
Yeah.
And they'd do it 30 days in a row. And how can how could anyone's brain survive that?
Yeah, she would she would lose big portions of her memory. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that...
Well, this was still the age of lobotomies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think when people describe seeing her back then during that period too, you know, sometimes they'll say, you know, she's like catatonic. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, her brain was really damaged by what they did to it.
And interestingly, Don and I did a research trip to Montgomery, Alabama, and we went to the Fitzgerald Museum, which is housed in a house in Montgomery that they lived in for a while. And when you see pictures of Zelda, even a few years after this, she looks like a completely different person. You would never know it was Zelda. And we think... You see the pain on her face, and you think it was the treatment that probably just did that to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anytime a movie or television show takes place in this particular period, there's always this danger of the set piece of the Roaring Twenties overwhelming the story, and the whole piece just devolves into kind of one loud, boozy party.
Yeah.
Was that a trap that you both had to be mindful of when approaching this material?
I think that just as writers who've been doing this for a while, I think we just know... You know, we stay with the character. You know, we keep telling our story, and we move through different periods. I mean, the fun thing about this season is every two episodes, we kind of change where we are, or kind of what the focus of the backdrop is. And so I think that I don't think we had to work that hard. Yeah. I think we just know that that's good storytelling.
And we had wonderful writers who were on our writing team who brought so much to the picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also wonderful music. I mean, I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of early jazz, Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, all of those things. Who did the music to this?
It was you know, all of the needle drops, per se, were Alex Petsavas,
okay,
who is, you know,
one of the greats. She really is. She's a great music supervisor.
You know, she's wow. done, you know, Mad Men, you name it. She's done all the.
Yeah, she does all of Shondaland. You know, she's just, she's everything.
And then we had a wonderful composer, Marcelo Zarbas.
Yeah.
A Brazilian composer who just brought so much feeling and heart, you know, and beauty.
And we had rules.
I'm hoping there's going to be a soundtrack, by the way.
Oh, there. I think there is already.
Oh, is there already?
On Amazon.
I literally looked, I think, a day or so ago,
after it came out. Yeah, so. I think there is. I think there will definitely be something there. But
we enjoyed listening to, well, like you were saying, we tried to keep the music. If it was 1918, then the music had to be from that.
The music that you hear on, like, that is happening is source, meaning it's happening in the scene, you know, like there's somebody playing a record. We tried to go with music that would have been playing at that time. The music that's on the soundtrack, we gave ourselves some leeway because, you know, sometimes you just need a great number.
Yeah.
You know, in the pilot, we actually had an orchestra re-record the songs that
oh, really?
We used in the dance. There are a couple of dance scenes.
Yeah.
What orchestra was it? Do you know? I mean, this is something that no one in the world cares about.
No,
nobody
gives
a shit about
this.
So
fabulous,
me.
And he
but I listened to
he did the music for what's his name?
Boardwalk.
Vince Giordano.
Yes, Vince Giordano.
Sorry, yeah, I really am a nut for this, like, crazy,
really
obscure
so
music.
It was Vince. Who,
yeah, I always find myself getting, you know, lured down rabbit holes on Spotify, crazy. You know, I start with Bessie Smith. Next thing you know, I'm.
Yeah.
God oh, my
where.
God. Oh, you would have had a wonderful time on this show.
And so Vince did re-record some of our numbers.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
Well, Nicole, I have to ask your dad. Legendary television writer producer Bud Yorkin, who was a producer on Maude, All in the Family, Sanford and Son, among others. I'd be curious, what was the most important thing, perhaps, that you learned from him about working in television?
That's so interesting. You know, my dad was comedy, and I, for the most part, done drama in my life and my career. But you know, he gave me a perspective on life. You know that. This isn't brain surgery, as they say. This is entertainment, and you know, you can only take it as seriously as you can take it, I guess. And the other thing that which is maybe more profound, is he always treated everybody really well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Don and I always try to maintain a policy of being kind and, you know, generous to people we work with, and then you get it back in spades. I think I learned that from my dad.
But I also want to throw in, you know, I think a lot of people, and she wouldn't say this, but I think a lot of people assume that, you know, because Nicole's father was a successful television producer, director at the time, that somehow he was pivotal to her being in the business.
Right.
And Nicole actually went the opposite direction. She ended up as a journalist working for the Herald Examiner.
Oh.
But then you know, she's a storyteller, and she ended up going to the American Film Institute, and that's where we met and we became partners, but writing partners. We are not lovers.
I love that you felt the need to preface that.
Oh, people think that all the time. So
you do have a nice patter.
I mean, it's been 25 years of being partners. So.
But
I did want to say that. So Nicole, I mean, her thing was she never wanted her dad to help, you know. And luckily, we really were veering off towards drama, and that wasn't his world. And so it was like we did the same thing that everyone else did and knocked on the doors endlessly for years before anyone read anything and took us seriously. So.
But you know what? He just really gave me perspective on the business that, you know, sometimes you get good reviews, sometimes you get bad reviews.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is, you just have to keep doing the work.
Did he ever try to push you into sitcoms?
You know, he never did.
No?
And I'm actually sad to say that he never got to see Z, because he died just 3 days after we finished making the pilot for Z's.
Yeah.
You know, and I told him about it along the way, and hopefully he understood what I was saying to him. And
I think history is proving that you went in the right direction here, because I can't. It's hard to even think of a sitcom anymore. So
the
whole genre seems to have died.
That's true.
Well, since you were a journalist, before we go, do you think that Zelda would have been at the Women's March?
For sure.
Yeah. Oh,
yes, yeah. We were at the Women's March in Washington. I brought my 8-year-old daughter.
We were. Wow. Yeah, we went.
And I brought my daughter. And, you know, Zelda was, for sure, she would have been out there.
Just for the drama alone.
Yeah.
She might have been on the stage.
Yeah. Well, again, the show is called Z, The Beginning of Everything. It's available on Amazon. Nicole Yorkin and Dawn Prestwich, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to David Hofflin, Dawn Prestwich, and Nicole Yorkin for joining me on the podcast. Watch the first season of Z, The Beginning of Everything, with a subscription to Amazon Prime. For more information, visit amazon.com/Z-the-beginning-of-everything. Or just go to amazon.com and type Z, The Beginning of Everything in the search box. Also, be sure to check out Dawn and Nicole's brilliant other show, The Killing, on AMC. Don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep the show free and find advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can like Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.